As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello, and welcome to another live edition of The Metrospective. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line by one of the Athletics Mets beat writers, Tim Britton. And Tim, season is over, but they face now, after that disappointment, a potentially extremely disappointing offseason.
Ted, first, I've got a question for you that, again, I don't know if you can answer, but I hope that someone listening can answer as quickly as we did when I asked that radio question several weeks back. So I recently moved to the suburbs 5 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to put this politely. What's going on with Halloween decorations in the suburbs?
That's everything.
I understood that, like, people decorated for Halloween more than they used to. There is a house in our neighborhood with an entire new graveyard in front of it, like a bunch of graves. And then the people that are out coming out of the graves, there's an otherwise well manicured house with dozens of skeletons clamoring up the front of it. I'm just confused.
I think that is the same phenomenon. Like, I think that people just go all out in more circumstances now. Like, the same thing I think is true of birthday parties. Like, when I was I don't remember anyone ever having a balloon arch at a birthday party when I was a kid, or even seeing that at birthday parties, like, in the park as of, like, 10 years ago. And now every time you pass a birthday party, it's like a more and more elaborate display for, like, a two-year-old who would be thrilled with a single balloon. I feel like this is all driven by Instagram, would be my guess, right? Like, everybody just, and so it becomes this, like, this game of one-upsmanship where, you know, by default you need to have an elaborate Halloween display, and then you want to have, like, the one with the most eye-catching, you know, show of zombies or whatever. That's going to get you the most Instagram likes and comments. I don't know that appeal, but I think that's the appeal.
Yeah, like, we went to a pumpkin patch over the weekend with our son, and we were there for about 8 minutes because we took one picture of him and a bunch of pumpkins, and that was it.
That's what you need to do. Then put it down on Instagram. It lives forever.
It was interesting to see, like, the number of people who were well dressed for the pumpkin patch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people, like, you know, this is suburban New Jersey. These are people who, like, came from New York to do this. And we're like, oh, this was, like, on the way somewhere else that we were going, and we decided to stop in. It's strange. I'm not ready for the modern world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to sort of just grow accustomed to the influencers among us. Right, because they are increasingly everywhere. I was at Disney World last week, so I saw a lot of it, and, like, just far, far, far more, more personalized shirts than you would have guessed. It feels like if you're going to go, and it's a big trip. Like, we happened to go because my wife had a work conference there. It was less of a big trip for us. But I think when you're doing something, it feels like everybody wants every occurrence to be so thoroughly documented that you need to go as far out. And we see it in baseball, too, right? Like, increasingly, no one is at the park not wearing team paraphernalia.
Well, I was going to say, we see it even in the clubhouse, where seemingly every minor event of the season is immediately immortalized in a T-shirt.
That
players wear around. The Mets had the combined no-hitter T-shirt. They had, I think they had a Mark Canna bat flip T-shirt. There's the Mark Canna summer T-shirt. Like, they're just an incredible amount of T-shirts that go into an average major league season these days. Like, a couple of years ago when the Mets had the salt and pepper shaker thing, was that 2019, 2018, the start of the year?
Yeah, every year it's a thing. Every year every team has something they do.
And that was the only shirt they wore all season. Like, you know, they got off, I think that was the year they got off the 11-1 start. And then, you know, they're under 500 by the end of May. And it was kind of a morose rest of the season, and you still saw guys wearing the salt and pepper shirt. It was like, oh, it almost felt immediately nostalgic. I actually saw someone wearing that shirt in the Citi Field stands this year. But now it's like, if you're wearing the shirt from 2 weeks ago, it feels overdone.
Right, like rat raccoon, come on. I mean, it's a former boss of mine is in the immediate T-shirt sport business that, like, we turn around, you know, athletic T-shirts or whatever, sports headline T-shirts quickly, and sometimes hits me up for ideas. And I think the only one I've contributed that became a T-shirt was that when, like, Pete Alonso first came up, there was a T-shirt that was just said, "For Pete's sake," and that was my idea. we can take questions on the actual Mets. If you've got some, please line up in the queue. Andrew L. in the comments wants to know your best Halloween costume. Do you have a best Halloween costume?
No, I just have a series of worst Halloween costumes. I was like, I'm just not creative enough to care about Halloween. Like,
I'm not prepared enough.
There was one year, I think I was in like fifth grade, where I was just going to go as a football player. And like, you know, you went to school as your costume. And I realized that, like, that was too juvenile. And so we had like a class-wide party that night, or maybe the day before, day after Halloween, and I decided to go as a zombie football player. So I just, you know, just added zombie makeup to really, you know, make it a more teenage costume.
I had an extraordinarily elaborate costume like one time in like fourth or fifth grade. My dad made it where it was like, it was one of these costumes. Now you see them pre-made. This was like a homemade deal where it looks like the monster is carrying me, you know. But it was really uncomfortable. And then they had to haul that around on Halloween when you're trying to like shave and cream your friends or whatever else. And so I think I wound up just becoming like, I changed and just was the monster. Otherwise, like nowadays I sort of default to if I have a reason to dress up for Halloween, I just dress as Marty McFly, 'cause I usually have the clothes necessary to be Marty McFly.
Yeah. That's like, I think the last costume, the last time I actually dressed up for Halloween was probably in college, and I just went as Michael Cera's character from Superbad, because that was just essentially my wardrobe. I'll just wear a hoodie. Like, that's, there we go.
Yeah, Evan was it? Was he Evan? Yes, right? Yes. Yeah.
I just ran awkwardly when the time came to run it all.
Right. I hate being the I'm too cool to dress up for Halloween guy. It's not that. It's that I just don't have it together enough to like think about getting a costume more than a few days in advance.
Yeah, it's too much work in life. You want to talk about the
Mets? And like, I'm 41 years old. We got some questions. Brian S. wants to know, who are the Mets most likely to sign? Trey Turner, Aaron Judge, Carlos Correa, or Carlos Rodon?
I would probably put Rodon at the top of that list, because if they do, if DeGrom does sign elsewhere, Rodon is the next big, he's the younger option on the free agent market. It's kind of DeGrom and Verlander are in their classes, probably shorter term, huge AAV deals. And then Rodon is the guy who might get, 5 years, at $28 million. He's still risky because he's you know, his track record of health is not very long. But I'd put him probably first. Then I would probably say Correa if the Mets were able to convince him to play third base. If he wanted to play third next to Francisco Lindor, he does not come. He can't get a qualifying offer, so it'd be a little bit easier to sign him. Mm-hmm. And then probably.
Well, except it would mean more suitors as well, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm interested in how his free agency plays out after the way it did last year. You know, all of those shortstops, because you've got Correa, Turner, Xander Bogaerts is likely to opt out of his deal with Boston, Dansby Swanson. That, you know, you've got four really good shortstops. Are there four teams that are willing to spend the amount of money it takes to sign those guys? We saw last year, you know, Texas signed two of them. We saw Trevor Story take a little bit less maybe than expected to play second base in Boston. You know, does there come a point in January, for instance, where like one of those guys is still out there? He's not going to play shortstop somewhere, and the Mets sign him to play second or third.
It's that question sort of leads to something Billy Epler spoke about a little bit, and something he wrote about really in depth, looking at, you know, where the Mets are financially and where they could be and should be moving forward. And when you look at the Mets roster, and you did, what's concerning is that they could spend $300 million again and have a significantly worse team.
Yeah, so I mean, like, they're, you know, to keep the band back together, they probably have to run the payroll closer to 360 or 370. And that's just bringing back basically the same team, which it would be a year older, where you're hoping for some improvement from, you know, guys have better years, but also some of your younger players, Alvarez, Beatty, Vientos among them, to step up. You know, if Steve Cohen said on the New York Post, the show podcast with John Heyman and Joel Sherman, you know, you think you should be able to build a pretty good team for $300 million, which is true. They just did it. They built a pretty good team for $300 million. It's just
they built a very good team for yeah. $300 million. Right? 101 wins is a very good team, no matter how it ends.
But their payroll obligations going forward, it's just about $225 million, and that's without any of those 13 to 15 free agents they have. That's with Steven Nogosic as your eighth inning setup man in front of Drew Smith in the bullpen. That's with, you know, Carlos Carrasco as your number two starter, Joey Lucchesi as your number five. So right. they've got a lot of space that they've got to fill in. And, you know, Epler said on Friday, kind of, you know, you don't build sustainability via free agency, which I think is true for the most part. You kind of use the free agency to supplement your roster, but mm-hmm. you acknowledge that, you know, they got to do a lot of supplementing, especially in their pitching staff, especially in that bullpen, where, you know, they haven't developed bullpen arms. That's an area where we've seen a lot of teams succeed with lower cost options. You know,
they developed Paul Sewald and Rafael Montero.
Well, yeah, you see those guys succeeding elsewhere. You know, it's kind of all of those trades they made in 2017 for relief arms and Smith. And Nogosic are the only two that have kind of made it, and made it is in quotes, because, you know, Nogosic is just an up and down guy. Smith is kind of, you know, good to be the third or fourth best guy in your bullpen. Probably not a guy you want to give the eighth inning every day. You know, they've got a lot of significant choices. And so it's, you know, when they say like we have a 101 win team, you know, we feel good about where we are. That's not really where you are. You don't have a 101 win team anymore. You have a team that won 101 games and is missing half its roster now. And so, you know, they have to decide on Jacob DeGrom, on Edwin Diaz, on Brandon Nimmo, on how they feel about Alvarez and Beatty as potential everyday contributors versus part-time contributors versus minor league guys at the start of the season. How much do you count on David Peterson and or McGill and Lucchesi in your rotation? You know, there's just a lot of different avenues that they can go in this offseason to define, you know, what the 2023 version of the Mets is going to be, and then down the line beyond that.
Let's go to the queue. Ben H. has been waiting. Ben, what's on your mind?
So basically all week, Tim, I've had your piece stuck in my head just describing the locker room after the season ended. And I don't know. Like, I can't kind of get the scene you describe of them not kind of being outright dejected and sad. And I guess my question for you is, because, like, you read baseball writers all the time, and when a season ends, they always talk about the guys being really sad, and like, other than Seth, like the guys that just stay in uniform for a very long time, and other than like Seth Lugo, that wasn't really the scene you described. I don't know. I guess just my question is, if you could go, just talk a little, like, is what you saw with the Mets, like, is that very abnormal that they had kind of come to terms with it? Is that more of what the world is and baseball writers try and make it seem a little bit more romantic? So I guess that's really my question. Like, do you have just any thoughts on why the scene was how it was? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question because it was a weird scene. So, you know, I don't have a huge surplus of experience in a clubhouse when a season ends in the playoff, but I don't have none. You know, I was there. Let me go through this. The 09 Angels ALCS, I was in their clubhouse after. The 09 Phillies when they lost the World Series, I was there after. The 10 Phillies when they lost the NLCS, I was there after. The Red Sox in 16 and 17 when they lost the Division Series, I was there after. I was there when they lost the final game in the 2011 season to complete their September collapse. All of those times, the clubhouse was more dejected than the Mets one scene. You talk about kind of the one player stuck in uniform, his head down. Like, that was the Phillies in 2010. I remember, you know, I was like the sixth sidebar guy for MLB.com, and I was writing about Ryan Howard, who had made the last out in the ninth inning. And my opening scene was Howard sitting there, head down. I think I compared him to a painting. And then, you know, our main Phillies writer, Todd Zalecki at MLB.com, had the exact same league because it was such a stark image. And the Mets, you know, Lugo was clearly sad. Like, Brandon Nimmo kept his uniform on for a long time. But there just seemed to be like, I don't know if it's necessarily coming to terms of that they were not going to win the World Series, or it was just like, hey, this is the playoff format. It's difficult to win. And we didn't. So, you know, that happens. It just, you know, like I said last time, Andy McCullough compared it to like the end of a pretty good party. You know, it seemed like, you know, the end of like a graduation party you have senior year of high school, where, you know, you're not going to see these guys together in a while, but you're pretty happy that you were together for as long as you were. That was just kind of the vibe I got. It was an interesting vibe. Andy's been in a lot more postseason clubhouses than I have, because he's covered the Royals, Dodgers, Yankees. Like, he's covered the postseason every year, and he thought it was kind of a weird vibe. So it's just, you know, it is what it is. I don't want to read too much into it. It was just not what I expected.
I mean, I have, as a longtime low man on the totem pole at USA Today covering the postseason, I've been in a bunch of those clubhouses. They're usually pretty sad. I would say, though, like, we praise the Mets all year long for professionalism, right? Like, these are professionals. These are veterans. These are guys who've been there before. And so, like, I don't know. Like, I would also be wary of, like, performative sadness in that spot, too, right? Like, Max Scherzer knows the story with the postseason series. It's three games. Sometimes you win them, sometimes you don't, right? Like, I don't know. I can't say, I'm not going to sit here and listen to anyone say like, oh, the Mets lost because they didn't care enough.
No, I don't think that's it. And, you know, they've also got a lot of veterans on this team, guys who have experienced postseason heartbreak, not just Scherzer, but guys like Bassett and Canna, who have seen their season, their, you know, really good regular seasons end in a one game wild card playoff in Oakland. You know, I don't think it's that they didn't care. I think that series in Atlanta, I don't know if it like dented their self-belief or anything like that, but it did seem to take a little bit out of
it. It dented mine.
And clearly, like, it dented the fan base's belief. Like, the game was not stalled out on Sunday night. You know, it made losing that early seem a lot more possible than it would have otherwise. You know, even if the Mets had lost the division somehow but had won a game in Atlanta, it would have felt, I think, a little bit differently than how having gone into that series, you know, with your three guys lined up. Like, you know, it was Nimmo after that Saturday game when they'd lost with DeGrom, they'd lost with Scherzer, who said, you know, we threw our best, they kind of stuffed it in our faces. And, you know, when that happens to you, it has to, I think it necessarily dents your confidence a little bit.
Let's hear from Jeff H., who has been waiting on the line. Jeff, what's going on?
Hi, guys. Jeff, Silver Spring, Maryland, and the National League Town Podcast. Pleasure to talk to you. Tim, thank you. Tim, you talked about the Mets' need for power, and I agree with you 100%. Pete needs somebody hitting behind him, but the problem is that there's all of the names you mentioned are wishes. Alvarez, Vientos, Beatty. The Mets need a Kyle Schwarber. I don't think they're going to trade for Wilson. Excuse me. I don't think they're going to sign Wilson Contreras. That's 20 home runs. So other than the aspirational young players, where do you see the Mets getting somebody to hit behind Pete?
It's a good question because the first option, of course, is Aaron Judge. And that is, you know, like, I think there is kind of the thought, the consensus in the sport that Judge probably goes back to the Yankees, right? That, of course, was what everyone thought about Freddie Freeman and Atlanta this time last year. So you never know with a big free agent like that. And I do think the Mets, you know, I assume they are seriously contemplating a run at Aaron Judge. And I think they should if they're not. Beyond him, there are some, you know, some different alternatives, you know, like a guy like. You know, a guy like Correa could make some sense. You know, Turner hits for power, but it's 20 home runs and it's more extra base power. You know, some guys that might make sense in the trade market, like Hunter Renfroe is a guy who you know, is a 30 home run hitter for Milwaukee and Boston the last couple of years. He might be available in a trade because it's the Brewers and he's going to make $11 or $12 million next year. Anthony Santander with the Orioles is a guy who is consistently brought up in trade conversations, a switch hitter who hits for power, but generally has a low on base percentage. You know, you worry about trying to add a single statistic too much at the expense of good players overall. Like you don't say like, well, we won't sign Correa because we want to get more power. We'll trade for Santander. You don't do that. But I do think it is important that they have kind of a fifth place hitter in that lineup, you know, especially if McNeil, you know, if you let Nimmo go and McNeil hops up to the top three, then you want to have someone, some bulk behind Alonso in a way they didn't really have for most of the year.
We got a good question in the chat from Bill B. Who says, going into the offseason or the 2023 season, what do you see as the organization's strength? For the longest time, it seemed like everyone pointed to the Mets starting pitching. No matter what the offense does, at least they have starting pitching. Now their starting depth seems extremely thin. Seemed like the Mets were set up to have so many DH options before it became universal. This season disproved that. What is the one thing that you can point to going into the offseason that say at least they have? Tim, I have an answer, but I want to hear yours.
Well, I would say right now it's probably their core four hitters that are returning, which is Alonso, who hit 40-plus home runs and drove in 131 runs. It's Lindor, who drove in more than 100 runs and you know, was worth, what, 6 or 7 wins above replacement. We'll finish probably in the top 10 in MVP voting. It's Starling Marte, who had an excellent all-around season and was kind of the glue, as we saw in September, of the top part of that lineup. And then it's McNeil, the returning National League batting champion. Like, you have those four hitters. That's a really good start to building out your lineup. You've got some veterans in addition to that, obviously, in Escobar and Canna and Vogelbach coming back. But that's probably the strength. But I can't say, like, organizationally, you know, you look at Cleveland, for instance, you say Cleveland develops starting pitching. That's what it does so well. That's why the Guardians are where they are. I don't think there's a part organizationally with the Mets where you say that's what they do better than anyone else right now, outside of they've got a lot of financial resources that they can devote to those kinds of things.
I would say, I mean, sort of the same idea. Like, I would, to me, it's just like, and I don't disagree with the idea that they could use another, like, big power bat, but their offensive depth, like, they already have an acceptable starting nine that they could run out there right now, right? And that's even with Nimmo leaving. So to me, it's that, you know, and that's without counting too much on Alvarez or Beatty or guys like that. Again, like, you want more of that depth, but going into the offseason where they are offensively, I think, is a strength. I think that the point is right, that starting pitching just isn't what it was coming into this season. It's Scherzer and Carrasco and a bunch of question marks.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
We've got Rob S. in the queue. Rob, what's going on?
So just a quick question. So I just wanted your opinion. I always thought that this season, even like just for how well they did, was more of a sort of like a transition season. The Scherzer, I don't know if they were meant to do so well now. My sense was like the Wilpons, like there was just a lot to unpack with the Wilpons in terms of the organization, in terms of like minor leagues and international scouting. So, I mean, is that accurate, or were they surprised at how well they did? I just want to get your sense of like, was this the year they really thought that they could win?
Yeah, I think they were taken aback by winning 101 games. I don't think they, if you said going into the season, well, you can win 101, they would have jumped at that. I think they would have jumped at 92. I think losing in the wild card series, that's probably, that's what I picked them to do going into the season. And I think that's probably what a reasonable expectation of this roster would have been going into the season, especially, you would have said like they'd be a toss up in a wild card series is kind of my thought going into the year. The way they looked at the team at the trade deadline certainly suggested that they thought that, this is kind of the first year of hopefully a run of contention. But the fly in the ointment of that is you've got 13 to 15 free agents, a lot of them really good players. It's not like this is the 2015 Cubs, where it's like, oh man, they got all the way to the NLCS. They won 97 games and everyone's coming back next year because they're all pre-arbitration players. This is a veteran roster, and the time frame for this specific roster's success is relatively brief. I've compared them to the 2013 Red Sox team that won the World Series, but had kind of a similar shape to the roster, and that team finished in last place in 2014 with a lot of the same guys back. I think if they're looking at it as the first year of a prolonged period of contention, they've got a lot of work to do to extend that window, because the team right now is kind of only half built.
Can I ask you a question that based on something that you wrote?
Sure.
So your guess was around $44 million a year for Jacob DeGrom, right?
I said kind of 40-ish. I don't know that he'll top Scherzer, but I think it's right in that ballpark.
So, and this is a sacrilegious question, and I realize that. Is there a case to be made? I want the Mets to bring back Jake DeGrom. I want the Mets to get DeGrom and Judge and Shohei Ohtani, right? Like, sign everybody, because it's not my money. But if there is a finite cap somewhere to the Mets payroll, is there a case to be made that they're better off spreading that money around the starting rotation than spending 40 million or 40 plus on DeGrom, since there are a handful of like the 10 to 15 million, your Chris Bassetts and your Taijuan Walkers and your Jameson Taillons and even up to Rodon. Like, would you rather have 2 to 3 other free agent starters than put all of your eggs in Jacob DeGrom's basket?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, absolutely there's that case to be made. I don't think anyone disputes that. I think if you're going to make the case the other way, the case kind of in favor of DeGrom, it's that, like, you know, let's say the Mets spread that money around. Let's say they take that $42 million and they sign 3 starting pitchers. They sign Walker, they sign Bassett, they sign Payon. Probably can't get all 3 of those for 42, but, you know,
no.
we'll say that for, you know, for the sake of the argument. You get into the postseason series, how good do you feel about your rotation matching up with someone else? It's Scherzer. You don't know, you know, the arguments we had the last month about Carrasco versus Walker for your game 5 starter, that's your argument for your game 2 starter. I guess it's Bassett in this instance. It's Scherzer, it's Bassett, then it's, you know, Walker, Carrasco, Taillon. Like, those are your 3, 4, 5. You know, I think you get into the postseason and you want, you know, we talk about depth and how important it is all season long. It is really why a team like the Dodgers is so good over 162. They're better in the top part of the roster through the 35th, 40th, 45th guy than anyone else. But you get into the postseason, the 35th guy doesn't matter. 30th guy doesn't matter. 25th guy doesn't matter. 20th guy doesn't really matter. It's really the top part of your roster. That's why I think LA hasn't done as well in the postseason, and why the 1 year they won was the year there were no off days in the postseason, because that depth mattered more that year. You know, you want Scherzer and DeGrom at the top of your rotation. You want that star level kind of performance at the expense maybe of who your 4th and 5th starters are. Maybe you say, okay, we can roll with McGill and Peterson as our 4 and 5 if it means we have Scherzer and DeGrom at the top. You know, we've got Lucchesi as our depth. Maybe you sign one more depth guy and you get through the regular season so that in the postseason you've got the best 1-2 possible that you can have. That's the argument in favor of it. You know, I'm sympathetic to both. Like, you know, if it's possible to get Rodon and Taijuan Walker or something like that, that's probably about $42 million. Maybe that's the best way to go. Kind of compromise where you've got a guy you feel really good in game 2 and you move from there. But you know, it's just a matter of where that you know, if there's a line on the payroll, we know it's not infinite, but we don't know where that line is and how close the Mets are to getting there.
I mean, because you might say, like, we talk about getting too cute, right? Like, if you're building with your postseason series in mind, I mean, it feels, first of all, sort of ambitious, right? You got to get there first. But then also, I mean, they were built this year like that, right? Like, they had Max Scherzer and Jacob DeGrom and Chris Bassett for a 3-game series. What could be better? And they still lost it, right? So I'm just playing devil's advocate, because I don't want people to tweet at me about how I hate Jacob DeGrom and want him off the team, anything like that. But just, like, shouldn't the main goal just be make the best team you possibly can and then roll the dice with the postseason? Because, like, again, like, no one would have guessed that the San Diego Padres starting rotation would have outpitched the Mets in that series, and they absolutely did. Right. And no one would have guessed that Joe Musgrove would be unhittable for the final month of the season. Those things happen. I don't know. It feels like those things just sort of happen, for one thing. And then also, like, you just want to have the best team possible to hope that those things are happening to you at the right time and you're already set up to make the postseason.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I would be leery of is having a kind of nihilism toward the postseason where your idea is just like, you know, like, nothing works in the postseason. Just, you know, every team's got a 1 out of 12 shot. Just get there. You know, just build the
best. That is absolutely, I will say, just either you are not going to convince me otherwise, but go on.
Right. Like just, I don't want a team, you know, and I think we'll see this in the sport, teams to say, like, let's just build the best 86 win team we can, get there and see what happens. Because I think, like, you look at San Diego and Philadelphia and you say, man, those are teams you didn't expect to be in the NLCS. Neither of them won 90 games. They're also top 5 payroll teams. San Diego has largely underachieved this year. Philadelphia underachieved for a large portion of the season. Like, they're good teams. They're well built. Well, they've got a lot of good players on the team. And, you know, it's not a surprise necessarily that San Diego could outplay the Dodgers in a 5-game series. Like, they've got enough talent to do that. They've got, you know, Darvish, Snell, and Musgrove. Clevinger is their fourth starter. That's a really good rotation. That's better than, for instance, a rotation where the Mets are just signing, Walker Bassett and Tyone. So I think there are things that work in the playoffs. They don't work all the time. They don't work 100% of the time. Hitting home runs is good in the playoffs. Having outstanding starting pitching is good in the playoffs. Having a few standout relievers is good in the playoffs. Like there are things that work in the playoffs more often than other things. I don't think it's necessarily 1 out of 12. Otherwise, Oakland would have advanced one of those years, right?
I don't think so. Like I really think if it's only 1 out of 12, then it's one out, like, I don't know. You can land on tails 6 times in a row, right? Like these things happen. I don't know. I just feel like if there were an obvious formula to winning in the postseason, you'd see more teams following it. And for all that we hear, great starting pitching and lots of home runs and a great bullpen, those things are good for baseball teams for any game of the season, right? And you're correct that it's not surprising that the Padres could beat the Dodgers in a 5-game series, but, like, would it be terribly surprising? Like, it would be a little bit surprising, but would it be, like, overwhelmingly surprising if the Rockies beat the Dodgers in a 5-game series?
No, I mean, that's baseball, right? That anything right. can happen in those short stints. You need, what, like a best of 71 series or something for it to actually
if you're saying that one team is better enough, this is sort of abstract, but so if you're saying that the Dodgers could have beaten the Padres 2 out of every 3 times, that's a big ask, right? Like if you think about baseball teams, like the worst baseball teams still win 50 games and the best baseball teams only win, well, the Dodgers won 111, but typically the best baseball teams win 100 to 105, right? It's not like the NBA or NFL where you get an 80% winning percentage ever. And so if the Dodgers were good enough to beat the Padres 66% of the time or 67% of the time, 2 out of every 3, to give them a 95% chance of winning a postseason series, it would need to be a best of 23 series. And if the Dodgers were only good enough to beat the Padres 55% of the time to give them to prove with statistical significance that they were the better team, meaning over 95% chance of winning, you'd need a 269-game series.
This reminds me of when I was a kid, my brother and I played a 21-game basketball series one-on-one. It was on a little, like, 6-foot hoop with a small basketball. And it went to game 21. We were playing to 100, and the final score was 199. And it was the most evenly matched series ever played in any sport ever.
That does sound that way. So are you convinced that he's better than you?
No, I won. I make that abundantly clear.
So there's a fluke.
And it cemented that I was better than him, not just at basketball on a 6-foot hoop, but at most things. That's the deciding factor between us. So I think there are, you know, yeah, you build the best team you can build. But I think there are a couple of things you keep in the back of your mind that they work a little, they're a little bit more important in the playoff. You know,
okay.
A higher percentage of runs are scored on home runs in the playoffs than elsewhere. You know, being good right. against good pitching is more important when you face good pitching in the playoffs than elsewhere. Those kinds of things. I'm not saying, like, you know, I don't want teams to just try to build the best 86-win team they can. I don't want the Mets to say, like, we don't need a fifth starter. You don't need that in the playoffs. We'll just roll with 4 and then just throw a fifth guy out there whenever we need it.
Right.
You know, I think there are limits to that mindset, but I don't want the team to just, like, we'll do whatever we can, but the playoffs really are not an indicator of any kind of talent.
No, I think that's fair. And I would say, like, certainly it does feel like having a lockdown bullpen is a great recipe for postseason success. I would just say, like, if I'm going into the season, if I'm going into spring training, I want the Mets to build the best team they can and worry about the postseason particulars when you get to the trade deadline. Like, oh, we could really use, for example, a strong right-handed bat and a good left-handed reliever.
Well, like, well, one thing about that is if you're in the position, like, you know, I remember covering the Red Sox, and that was generally how they viewed, they're like, you know, let's see what we've got for 4 months. And then, you know, we could sign this guy to fill this possible hole in the offseason, but let's see where we are. We can always trade for someone like him in July. If you're going to take that approach, you've got to be willing to trade pieces in July.
Right.
So, like, you know, if the Mets approach last year was like, we'll fill the lefty reliever thing if it's really an issue on by August 2nd, but we don't want to trade any of our top 20 prospects, that's, you can't have both of those. So if you're not planning, you know, if you want to hold on to your prospects as much as they've indicated they want to hold on to them, then I think you've got to be a little bit more aggressive in free agency to fill potential weaknesses and not just obvious ones.
What's Andrew Chafin up to this offseason?
Probably opting out of his deal. I think he's got 1 year and $6.5 million left on it with Detroit. He is, I believe, Cody Stavenhagen, our Tigers writer, wrote a little bit about Chafin in his season wrap up. That he is, you know, I did not know he was native to the Midwest, and so maybe wants to stick around in Detroit. But probably opting out and seeing if he can get more money this offseason than he did last offseason.
He has a very Detroit mustache, right? Like Tom Selleck. And that is another Halloween. That's to go back to our earlier question. Another go-to Halloween costume for me is Magnum P.I., you know, just a Detroit Tigers hat and a fake mustache. You know, maybe Andrew Chafin sort of always wanted to be like Tom Selleck growing up. Paul S. in the chat has a question. For 40 to 45 million, I guess, per year, DeGrom or Judge? Discuss.
I mean, I think, well, first of all, Judge should not take quite as much as DeGrom takes per year, but it's going to be a longer term commitment.
Right. It's a different type of commitment.
Yeah. I would probably, you know, I think you lean on the position player in those kinds mm-hmm. of arguments, just because they impact the game every day and they generally stay healthier. You know, it's a question of, do you trust Aaron Judge at 38 or Jacob DeGrom at 36, 37? You know, there's probably a wide enough age difference that the contract length is kind of evened out. So in that instance, I'd probably go with Judge.
So do you have a choice?
Yeah. I'd say Judge in that
yeah.
particular one-on-one.
I think so too. I mean, I think that and again, like, sacrilege, but there's the certainty of the position player. There's so much less risk of injury, you know, and when you're talking about investing that much, especially when you've already got quite a bit invested in a late 30s starter in Max Scherzer, like, spread it out. Judge is not going to stop being a great hitter anytime soon. And there's some chance that DeGrom, like, and no one wants to sort of consider this possibility, but there's always a chance that DeGrom has, you know, two more, three more seasons of 10 to 15 starts. And then, you know, you could have had Aaron Judge for 155. Let's see what else we've got in the chat, because no one's in the queue right now. Do you think Madison Bumgarner could be had in a trade, maybe in a salary swap with James McCann?
I would imagine Arizona would be interested in unloading Bumgarner's salary. I believe he has at least a limited no trade clause. It is likely in that instance that he would have New York on it, because I don't think he wants to pitch here. He's got, I'd have to look it up, I think it's 2 years and 30-something million dollars left. McCann is 2 years and 24. With McCann, you know, we've got another question in the chat along these lines, since they've got, you know, three potential major league catchers in Nito, McCann, and Alvarez. You know, do you try to trade Nito maybe because you get more value for him? I think the likeliest option here with those three guys is they carry all of them, because Alvarez, you're not quite sure, is ready to be a major league catcher. And, you know, if you want to use him as a DH, you kind of want to have a third catcher on your roster, just for, you know, bench reasons and flexibility reasons. So that would be my guess is what they do. But if you wanted to trade McCann, it would probably be eating, I would think, 14 to 16 of the $24 million left on his deal, and trading him, you know, looking around at what kind of teams need a catcher. Like, the Pirates made a deal or signed Roberto Perez before last offseason because they wanted a veteran catcher to deal with a young pitching staff. Maybe you pitch them on McCann, filling that same kind of role for about the same amount of money they paid Perez, who got hurt early in the year. That's the kind of deal that, you know, and you get a lottery ticket of a high A relief arm back. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
Right. There's no way you're going to, it seems to me like the upside on Bumgarner, even after some lousy seasons, is still worth more than what you can expect paying $12 million for James McCann. Like, that doesn't seem like a straight up swap to me.
It's, you know, do you run, like, I think it's easier to hide like if McCann is your third catcher on your roster, you know, you're not exposing him as much. It's like, it's harder to hide Bumgarner. Is he just become a long man if he struggles again, if his ERA is up over five?
Right.
It's been the last couple of years.
I mean, they still need a lefty reliever, you know?
Does he become your left-handed specialist? You know, how unhappy is a player that, you know, McCann, I am sure, is not happy with a reduced role, but he can probably come around to accepting it a little bit more than Madison Bumgarner might if he's traded somewhere he doesn't really want to go.
Do you know I've played cornhole with Madison Bumgarner?
Was it Madison Bumgarner or what was it? Mason Thompson?
I forget, because I was it's his wife's maiden name is whatever the last name he uses, which is also like so his father-in-law sort of, I think, runs his ranch in the off season. All of these people were around when I was there playing cornhole.
Mason Saunders.
Yeah. No, he's also an exceptionally good cornhole player. Like, really, really, really good.
I mean, like, that, I would expect that, right? Like, he's able to throw something much harder.
Well, he's huge, you know. So like his arm, once he gets his arm extended, he's like halfway to the other board. far better. Also there, I was at his ranch in North Carolina where they were filming a commercial, and the guy filming the commercial, and I hadn't watched Game of Thrones yet. So he was not as big a deal to me, other than the way he looked physically, which was incredible, was Jason Momoa, the guy who, you know, the huge guy from Game of Thrones. He was directing the commercial. He was not quite as good at cornhole.
Right. Yeah. It's funny because you said Jason Momoa, and I was like, he wasn't on Game of Thrones. But then I remembered that is actually where he got his start.
Right. Right. Now he is like notable as this incredible looking guy. And Aquaman.
That's right.
Let's see, one more from the chat. Do you know, I mean, I guess this sort of points to something that we spoke of earlier. Richard A. wants to know, what is the team's farm system looking like on the pitching front? He mentions Vassell, Hamill, and Allen, and Matt Allen. You tell me, there are not a lot of well-regarded pitching prospects in the Met system, as far as I know.
Yeah, I would not expect any help from within the system in 2023 from the pitching side of things. You know, I think your depth is going to be that McGill, Peterson, Lucchesi, maybe Jose Buteau group. Buteau might end up being a reliever himself. You know, Vassell, actually, Keith Law at The Athletic has some scouting notes on Vassell, along with outfielder Brandon McIlwain on his latest story about the Arizona Fall League. You know, he said Vassell potentially intriguing, but probably projects more to be a reliever. You know, Allen has thrown, I think, 10 and a third professional innings since being drafted in 2019 because of the pandemic, and then his Tommy John surgery. So he's got a ways to go. You know, Hamill, like these guys are decent prospects, but they're not. For most organizations, they would not be the top pitching prospect. But for the Mets, they are, because of how many pitching prospects they've moved. And look, it's not necessarily a bad bet to consistently bet against your pitching prospects, right? What is the old baseball perspective? There is no such thing as a pitching prospect.
Right.
Like, Anthony Kay has not come back to bite the Mets. Justin Dunn has not come back to bite the Mets. We'll see if Simeon Woods Richardson, now in Minnesota after being traded a second time, comes back. Bite the Mets, or JT Ginn, who Law wrote about kind of maybe having a relief profile as well. Like, those guys haven't come back to bite them, but at some point you have to develop your own, you know, if you can be Cleveland in terms of developing your starting pitching, or if you can be the Dodgers in terms of developing other people's starting pitching once you get them in your system, then it makes it a whole lot easier, rather than paying $42 million for Jacob DeGrom, $43 for Max Scherzer, or whatever it costs for Rodon or Bassett and all those guys.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly does seem to be, like, there are teams that have the pitching magic, right? And the Mets have yet to become one of them. That is definitely a frontier to pursue as they, like, take on a what seems like a larger front office, right? Like, are they building out in the front office still?
Yeah, I mean, they're adding where they can. But, you know, I wrote a story at the start of the 2021 season about how they wanted to build a pitching lab. And most of the guys involved in that project have left.
Right.
They haven't built that out. It just hasn't been. They haven't gotten a move on that. And that, you know, that
Who are the guys? Because how much can Cleveland possibly be paying these people, right? Like, just hire them all. Hire every single person. Right? Steve Cohen. You got $28 billion or whatever it is. Like, siphon off $1 billion and get all of the pitching guys.
Well, what's interesting is, like, how much colleges have been ahead of the curve in this regard. Like, Wake Forest,
yeah, which
is the smallest Division I Power 5 school, whatever, you know, smallest in terms of enrollment, has maybe the best pitching infrastructure of any college in the country. Or one of, you know, and we've seen teams take pitching coaches from college the last few years. We've seen colleges take pitching coaches from the majors with LSU and the Twins. You know, it doesn't take on this massive, overwhelming investment. It's just hiring the right people and doing the work. And the Mets have been behind in it for so long that the work they're talking about doing is really just catching up. It's not being at the forefront of the industry yet.
On that note, I suppose we can sign off hoping that the Mets will soon be at the forefront of the industry, but not before the end of the World Series, which is not going to feature them. I didn't think of a good way to wrap this show up, Tim.
that was depressing. We'll be back next week. I think we'll do our regular recorded episode, and then 2 weeks from now we will round up our Halloween in a live episode. Is that the plan?
That sounds good to me.
Sure.
All right. Until then, peace out.
Adios.